Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Norman Solomon, co-founder of the activist group RootsAction.org, who examines the Biden administration's role supporting Israel's savage war in Gaza and U.S. weapons being used to kill tens of thousands of civilians. Media critic Parker Malloy, publisher of the Present Age newsletter, who explains why she believes the political media's practice of sane-washing Trump's incoherent rants poses a threat to informed democracy. And climate activist Sidney Collins, who opposes the expansion of a New England frack gas pipeline, talks about the destructive impact of fossil fuel infrastructure on rural communities and on society. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
2 years after Sri Lanka's worst economic crisis since the Great Depression and default on its external debt, citizens of the South Asian island elected leftist Anuradhakumara Dissanayake, a member of the leftist JVP party that once waged violent insurrections in the early 1970s and the late 1980s, but has since adopted more moderate policies and is now calling on the International Monetary Fund to scale back its harsh debt repayment plan. Sri Lanka will be holding parliamentary elections in 7 weeks, and the outcome will determine Dissanayake's bargaining power with the IMF and the extent to which he can keep the country's elite at bay. Illustrating the danger for the new president, IMF austerity measures in Kenya led to massive protests which forced President William Ruto out of office. Sri Lanka's poor have high expectations that Dissanayake will strike a deal with the IMF to lower high prices for food, energy, and medicine. The National Labor Relations Board filed a complaint against retail giant Amazon for illegally refusing to bargain with a union representing drivers employed by a contractor. The NLRB complaint claims that Amazon is a so-called joint employer of drivers for the contractor, battle-tested strategies, or BTS, and used a series of illegal tactics to discourage union activities at a facility in Palmdale, California. BTS drivers voted to join the Teamsters Union last year, becoming the first Amazon delivery contractors to unionize. In its complaint, the NLRB said Amazon broke the law by terminating its contract with BTS after the drivers unionized without first bargaining with the Teamsters. The NLRB ruling is a blow to Amazon's third-party business model of outsourcing delivery jobs. In mid-September, a majority of drivers at 3 Amazon driver contractor sites in Queens, New York, signed union authorization cards, forcing Amazon to either recognize the union or contest the card count and officially hold an election. On the campaign trail, Vice President Kamala Harris talks about the nation's housing crisis, but has failed to issue a detailed policy that protects tenants from unsustainable rent increases. During the presidential debate, Harris put Trump on the defensive by calling for new housing construction and down payment assistance. But the Democratic nominee rarely uses the words tenants or renters in her campaign speeches. On July 30th, just after Joe Biden left the race, the administration advocated for the adoption of a limited rent cap after years of record rent increases during the pandemic. But the Nation magazine reports that the administration now has the authority to enact the rent cap proposal without Congress, but made an active choice not to, weaponizing it as a reason to elect future Democrats instead. At least 22 million renter households, nearly half of all renters, are cost burdened, meaning they pay more than 30% of their income toward rent. While the Biden administration has seen a surge in construction of multifamily housing this spring, the median rent for these units, $1,710 a month, is out of reach for many tenants. Over the past 20 years, average rents have increased over 20%, while median renter household income has risen only 2%. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
October 7th marked the one-year anniversary of the Hamas terrorist attack on Israel that killed 1,200 Israelis and kidnapped 240 hostages brought back to Gaza, of which approximately 100 remain in captivity. Since the Hamas attack, Israel has unleashed a savage war on Gaza that's killed more than 42,000 Palestinians, mostly civilians, including 17,000 children. In recent months, Israel has assassinated leaders of Hamas, Hezbollah, and high-ranking Iranian military officials in Beirut, Tehran, and Damascus, as well as weaponizing pagers and walkie-talkies to attack thousands across Lebanon. In retaliation for the assassinations and Israel's current air and ground invasion of Lebanon that's killed more than 2,000 civilians, Iran launched a second wave of 180 missiles at Israel, causing little damage. In the midst of this widening regional Middle East war, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to retaliate against Iran in the coming days. In his book titled War Made Invisible, published last year, author Norman Solomon examined the ways in which the U.S. wages war around the world as it works to conceal the death and destruction resulting from America's bombs and missiles, often aided by the nation's corporate media. In a just-published revised edition of the book, Solomon has added a new chapter on the Gaza War. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, co-founder of the activist group RootsAction.org, who examines the Biden administration's unconditional support for Israel in the current conflict, where billions of dollars worth of U.S. weapons have aided Israel in killing tens of thousands of civilians in Gaza and now in Lebanon.
The state of affairs is really an extrapolation of what was launched after 2001, the so-called War on Terror. And a lot of what I think needs to be talked about is the underlying U.S. media and political attitude that if a crime is committed against the United States or against an ally, in this case Israel, that it's perfectly okay to consider that crime to justify anything that is done in response. So in the case of 9/11, the United States now for really 23 years and has continued, although very little media coverage, has continued to engage in warfare in many countries. And the Cost of War Project at Brown University has documented that the direct deaths from that U.S.-led war in the past two decades plus have added up to about 950,000 people. And then the indirect deaths added in, we're talking 4.5 million people have died as a result of retribution, we were told, response to the killing of 3,000 people on September 11th, 2001. It was really notable to me that the day after October 7th, and yes, October 7th was a terrible crime against humanity committed by Hamas, both the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations and the Israeli ambassador to the United States both used the identical phrase, "This is our 9/11." And again, it was an aggrieved country using a crime against humanity that they suffered as a kind of a blank check to kill, what I call in the book, a license to kill with no expiration date. And now we've seen a year after October 7th, 2023, the continuing slaughter of civilians, most of them children and women. We know of 42,000 in Gaza, many thousands more buried under the rubble. All these numbers are inadequate to describe the human suffering or the magnitude of the suffering, and 100,000 injured, and warfare in the form of forced starvation, which is another form of war crime. So we're really seeing patterns that have replicated the U.S. government's role in its so-called war on terror being waged now by the Israeli government.
Thank you for that, Norman. One feature of the protest that has been held on hundreds of college campuses around the country and protests elsewhere all across the world against the mass slaughter of civilians in Gaza by Israel is the conflation of criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. Norman, I wondered if you would talk about some of the internal dissent and contradictions we see in U.S. media when it comes to covering Israel and following the government's line that everything that's befallen the Palestinians is their own fault, which is pretty much what Israeli officials almost say on a daily basis.
Well, part of the backdrop, as you note, and it has intensified in the last year, is the reflexive response that when criticism of Israel happens, it's anti-Semitic. And as a Jewish American, I find that particularly offensive. But it doesn't matter what our background is, whatever religion, race, ethnicity, it should be morally and intellectually repugnant to be having this thrown at us when the scam should be obvious. The Israeli government and its allies wrap its own atrocities in the Jewish religion. And so it's a very straightforward propaganda maneuver. The news media coverage in this country has overall been disproportionate in its emphasis and coverage as to the human suffering of this conflict. And let's cite some statistics. In the first 6 weeks after October 7th, the New York Times, Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times used the word slaughter 60 different times to describe what Hamas did to Israelis on October 7th. Those same media outlets used the word slaughter only once to describe what Israel had done to people in Gaza. Let's look at the word massacre. The New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, in those first 6 weeks, used the word massacre 125 times to describe what was done to Israelis, only twice to describe what was being done to Palestinians in Gaza. This is very Orwellian. This is a measurement of how unbalanced U.S. media coverage is in terms of its political and social and emotional communications. And it's a devaluation of some human beings and saying that really some lives matter and some lives don't. And we should reject that kind of messaging, which is often implicit and is very extreme.
That was Norman Solomon, co-founder of the activist group RootsAction.org and author of the book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. Learn more about the book and find links to related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. At 78, disgraced, twice impeached, and 34-time criminally convicted former President Donald Trump is now the oldest major party candidate for president in U.S. history. With President Joe Biden's withdrawal from the campaign, there's been renewed focus on Trump's age and his obvious cognitive decline in recent years. In his speeches and interviews, Trump still fumes about his false allegation that the 2020 election was stolen from him, and engages in incoherent rants about fictional movie character Dr. Hannibal Lecter while issuing bizarre tirades on sharks and electric batteries. More dangerously, Trump repeats lies that Haitian immigrants are eating pets in Springfield, Ohio, advocates for a violent day of policing that will end crime, and dishonestly accuses Democrats of supporting the murder of babies after they're born. After Hurricane Helene carved a trail of destruction Across the southeast U.S., Trump spread potentially deadly disinformation, charging that the federal government's rescue efforts are excluding Republican voters and that emergency FEMA funds are being diverted to immigrants. Media critic Parker Malloy, publisher of the Present Age newsletter, wrote a piece for The New Republic on September 4th titled, "How the Media Sanitizes Trump's Insanity," accusing corporate media outlets of sane-washing Trump's unhinged behavior by rewriting and reframing his words to create the illusion that the Republican candidate is rational and lucid. Your reporter spoke with Parker Malloy, who explains why she believes the political media's practice of sanitizing Trump's unhinged speech poses a threat to informed democracy.
The term sane-washing kind of took off. So I wrote this article that the New Republic published about it. And then I think it was the very next day, Trump was giving a speech at the New York Economic Club, and he was asked about child care costs. And he went on a 2-minute rant about tariffs and all sorts of other things. And it was just such a perfect example of sane washing, because the way it was covered was as though it was a candidate giving a speech at an economic forum, you know, where you didn't get the fact that he was talking for 2 minutes uninterrupted, rambling about tariffs and how tariffs alone would lower the cost of childcare somehow. And so I think that that's why the term kind of stuck and took off the way it did.
Parker, when major media outlets like the New York Times and some of the big news networks cover for Trump, sanitize his remarks, make him sound more rational and lucid, what's the motivation for that? And I always think about the kinds of games that major media play, labeled as both sidesism, false equivalence, fear of being labeled the quote-unquote liberal media. How much of that do you think plays into this cleanup that the media has done for so long on Donald Trump and what he says?
I think it plays a significant role in that. I believe it does. I do think that there's some aspect of it where journalists have been watching Trump so long that they've kind of baked in the decline. They've baked in everything that, you know, that makes Trump Trump, and then they're trying to just give people the rest of the story. But most people aren't as plugged in, and I think that you do have situations where journalists will, to avoid coming off, giving the appearance of being biased, to try to fight back, you know, proactively fight back against charges of being liberal, you know, of having some sort of anti-conservative bias, which is something that gets talked about all over and over. And that was one of the things that, you know, on the left, there's Media Matters, and that's one of very few organizations that focus on looking at the problems in media from the left. But on the right, there are so many resources that are put to try to push this narrative that the media is liberal, the media has a bias against conservatives. And I think that there are a lot of reporters, a lot of journalists, a lot of editors who want to avoid that sort of criticism. And so they grade Trump on a curve. They write about him in a way that if Kamala Harris went out and did the same exact thing, they write about him differently. And that's the problem right there. They write about him differently than they would about any other candidate.
That was media critic Parker Malloy, publisher of the Present Age newsletter and former editor-at-large at Media Matters for America. Find links to Malloy's recent articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Project Maple is the New England-y sounding name for a major expansion of an existing fossil fuel pipeline, the so-called Algonquin Pipeline, that carries fracked gas or methane across New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. The pipeline's owner, Enbridge, is the same company that built the Line 3 pipeline from the Canadian tar sands in Alberta across several states in the upper Midwest, including northern Minnesota, as well as the Line 5 pipeline across Michigan. The company has yet to file a proposal for Project Maple with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for the needed permits, but it's been building small components for the expansion along the pipeline route. In late September, the Connecticut contingent of a four-state coalition called Stop Project Maple held a rally outside the Capitol building in Hartford, after which it delivered a letter to Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont asking him to deny permits for all future fossil fuel infrastructure. One of the speakers at the rally was Sidney Collins, a recent college graduate and young climate activist. Enbridge operates a compressor station on the pipeline near her small hometown, which transports the gas along the pipeline and produces toxic emissions. As extreme weather events, like climate change-fueled hurricanes Helene and Milton, ravage the southeast U.S., Collins addresses the destructive impact of fossil fuel infrastructure on rural communities and on the nation more broadly.
When I first learned about the climate crisis, I was shocked. It sunk my heart. The trees, rain, and the stars were my sense of safety and community. And how could our planet be in harm's way and no one was doing anything about it? As I got older and my struggles with family intensified, I was really scared. I was scared of family chaos and scared of what our future held. And I learned to people please and hide my truth, thinking denial and avoidance was my way to hold on to safety. When I went to college and began studying environmental science, there was no way to avoid the truth anymore. It was staring me right in the face. While I had spent years avoiding tough conversations at home, I was facing an even bigger one with myself. How could I stay silent in the face of something so urgent and so pressing as the climate crisis?
Thank you.
During late college, I found myself at the doorsteps of the Yukon recovery community, and I started to explore my own recovery. I was scared, but there was a sense of hope knowing that my home life could be more whole than the alcoholism, substance misuse, and loneliness that my home life grew to know. Recovery means being vulnerable, being scared, admitting I feel helpless, and asking for help. I was and am still terrified, and it means constantly challenging the defense mechanisms I have and still want to hold on to. However, recovery isn't easy, because the more I started to honor myself and my story, I had to honor the even more terrifying truths. The truth that we're in a climate crisis and young people have a future where they don't know how ugly it will be. Recovery has shown me what it actually means to feel alive and whole and connected. And how tragic is it at the same time my recovery has shown me that that is not guaranteed. Because in the face of the climate crisis, we see worsening storms, extreme heat, sea level rise, threatening the lives of million people today. Because big companies and governments have determined that the lives of young people are worthy of being abused. Even harder, my recovery has shown me that I'm not alone in my struggles and they're not my damn fault. Because there are layers of systemic problems and oppressive systems that we exist in that victimize so many communities with the same or worse struggles that I and my family face. From our economic system to racial violence to the brutalizing military industrial complex and so much more. I found that this fight we are showing up for today is more than just about fossil fuels. It's about justice and liberation and reclaiming our right to live. Because fossil fuels, they don't just fracture our land, they fracture our communities and strip us of our right to feel safe, connected, and whole. Rural communities like mine often suffer from high rates of alcoholism, community isolation, loneliness, which can be attributed to fossil fuels and the culture and system it supports. Studies show communities near extraction sites experience greater levels of isolation and up to 40% higher rates of substance misuse and mental health challenges. And this is specifically targeting low-income communities, communities of color, and indigenous communities. Communities of high levels of fossil fuel dependency report lower levels of community trust, destroying our social networks and support. And there's over 17 million people in the U.S. that live within half a mile of fossil fuel infrastructure. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to lose anyone else to alcoholism, substance misuse, or suicide. This is not just a threat to our communities, but it's a threat to our fragile democracy. The rise of political polarization and extremism can be traced back in part to the rise of fossil fuels in a capitalistic system. Our fossil fuel industries prey on rural communities, infiltrating them with toxic culture of hyper-independence, economic instability, and exposure to toxins, leaving people feeling abandoned and desperate for connection and care. And right-wing groups know this, and they victimize people to extremist and violent ideologies in search for blame and feelings of belonging. But my friends, my brothers, my sisters, I'm here to tell you that it's not our fault. We live amongst industries and economic systems that thrive by exploiting our planet and our people. I stand with you today, fighting against projects like Project Maple, and fossil fuel companies Enbridge that continue to harm communities like mine and like yours. When we fight against these industries, we're not just fighting for cleaner air or lower emissions, we're reimagining a world where we and our planet can heal.
Excerpts of the speech by climate activist Sidney Collins at a Stop Project Maple rally in Hartford, Connecticut in late September were recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Learn more about the coalition opposing New England's Project Maple frack gas pipeline by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on 3A Oldies in Epsom, New Hampshire, WHYR in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, KSER in Everett, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.